Here's David Cameron speaking after he met the Dalai Lama in 2008.
So today I met the Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader of the Tibetan people, and had a meeting with him here in my office. What we were talking about was the situation in Tibet today, the problems that there have been, the opportunity for dialogue with the Chinese about there being greater autonomy for Tibet.
And here's the Prime Minister speaking in China this week.
I believe it is also the right moment to shift our relationship up a gear. That is why I brought 6 senior ministers with me on this visit. That is why we're visiting 3 cities to understand this vast country better and to help China understand Britain too.
But China's perception of Britain was made very clear in an editorial in the state-run Global Times. Under the heading China Won't Fall for Cameron's Sincerity, the last word in talking marks, the paper wrote,
"The Cameron administration should acknowledge that the UK is not a big power in the eyes of the Chinese. It's just an old European country, apt for travel and study."
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Fellow South Africans, our beloved Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, the founding president of our democratic nation, has departed. He passed on peacefully in the company of his family around 2050 on the 5th of December 2013. He is now resting. He is now at peace. Our nation has lost its greatest son. Our people have lost a father. Although we knew that this day would come, nothing can diminish our sense of a profound and enduring loss. His tireless struggle for freedom and him the respect of the world. His humility, his compassion, and his humanity and him their love. Our thoughts and prayers are with the Mandela family. To them we owe a debt of gratitude. They have sacrificed much and endured much so that our people could be free. Our thoughts are with his wife, Mrs. Graca Machel, his former wife, Miss Winnie Madikizela Mandela, with his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, and the entire family. Our thoughts are with his friends, comrades, and colleagues who fought alongside Madiba over the course of a lifetime of struggle. Our thoughts are with the South African people who today mourn the loss of the one person who, more than any other, came to embody their sense of a common nationhood. Our thoughts are with the millions of people across the world who embraced Madiba as their own and who saw his cause as their cause. This is the moment of our deepest sorrow. Our nation has lost his greatest son. Yet, what made Nelson Mandela great was precisely what made him human. We saw in him what we seek in ourselves. And in him we saw so much of ourselves. Fellow South Africans, Nelson Mandela brought us together, and it is together that we will bid him farewell. Our beloved Madiba will be accorded a state funeral. I've ordered that all flags of the Republic of South Africa be lowered to half mast from tomorrow, 6 December, and to remain at half mast until after the funeral, as we gather to pay our last respects, let us conduct ourselves with the dignity and respect that Madiba personified. Let us be mindful of his wishes and the wishes of his family. As we gather, wherever we are in the country and wherever we are in the world, let us recall the values for which Madiba fought. Let us reaffirm his vision of a society in which none is exploited, oppressed, or is possessed by another. Let us commit ourselves to strive together, sparing neither strength nor courage, to build a united, non-racial, non-sexist, democratic, and prosperous South Africa. Let us express, each in our own way, the deep gratitude we feel for a life spent in service of the people of this country and in the cause of humanity. That is indeed the moment of our deepest sorrow. Yet, it must also be the moment of our greatest determination. A determination to live as Madiba has lived, to strive as he has strived, and to not rest until we have realized his vision of a truly united South Africa, a peaceful and prosperous Africa. and a better world. We will always love you, Madiba. May your soul rest in peace. God bless Africa. Osisikeleli Africa. I thank you.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land!
Indian land!
Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here. Indian
land! You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you speak? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. White man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart of original.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Times, Obama's path shaped by Mandela's story. Washington Post, Mandela's cause shaped Obama's political awakening. What? You know who shaped Obama's political awakening? I gotta be real careful because if you start getting into Mandela's politics, I mean, what was the African National Congress after all? They were communists. I mean, they were. Well, there's always a reason. There was a reason. But I don't even want to go there. But it's true. But I mean, this is the soap opera. This is exactly what this is, the Washington soap opera. This is the hero. And I tell you, folks, that characterization of my buddy Andy McCarthy came up with just perfect to describe. There is no news. There is no media. It is the daily soap opera, the daily suspense and the building up of heroes and so forth. Political, Barack Obama and Mandela. Inspiration.
Tout intelligent de radio.
Internet radio for smarter originals.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from AboriginalNewsWire.tumblr.com and AboriginalPress.wordpress.com and ang-newswire.blogspot.com. Thanks for tuning in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliteral, neoliberal, neo-fascist, and neo-misogynist control. I wish to welcome you all to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along. Welcome along. I wish peace to the gods and earths and love and solidarity to the entire original family. For this is indeed a time of strife and struggle. I'm your host, Angry Indian, and I'm here with our executive producer and engineer, Guadalupe Morales. And on behalf of the Aboriginal News Group, the editors, contributors that do what they can to keep this project going, we wish to extend our condolences to the family of brother Nelson Mandela, to his countrymen, to his supporters. You know, for those of us who have always been down with what this man has been about, what he fought for, what he sat in a white man's prison for. And, you know, that needs to be said. It needs to be said, it needs to be pointed out, it needs to be clarified, because we have a lot of conservatives. And I don't care which side of the political gate they're on, you know, left or right wing. We have a lot of conservatives who have never supported the African National Congress, who have never supported African liberation in Africa, have never supported African people anywhere in the diaspora, and who have never supported Nelson Mandela as an activist, as an African, as a man, or as a human being, to now flood the internet and the newspapers across the world with how much they respected him and how much they respected his struggle and how they were always down with what Mandela was going for. Well, you know, let's just call that what it is right now. It's a whole lot of bullshit. You know, it's a whole lot of boilerplate platitudes to pretend that these white men, and I'm including Obama in this. Barack Obama's a white man, right? And this, if this doesn't prove it to African people, I really don't know what will. How dare he say that he was inspired through his entire you know, school years, all of his formative years, that this is what helped him, you know, build the fortitude to become the first black president of the United States, because he wanted to follow in the footsteps of Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela didn't oversee a privatized prison system that locked up primarily his own people. Because, see, that system was already in place, and he just didn't do anything to change it. But he didn't, you know, he didn't speed it up. He didn't speed it up. That certainly wasn't the intent, and these are one of the contradictions. It's a real paradox, because while Mandela stood for one thing, and then he got out of prison, and we saw what happened, right? The only thing that changed about South Africa, well, the only two things, well, actually, let me be correct. The only three things that changed about South Africa was, one, the appearance of the leadership, right? So it actually reflects the indigenous population, which is also, of course, the majority population of the nation. But, you know, we're talking about a nation where they're actually keeping the borders of the Republic of South Africa. So what's changed? Anglo-American is still there. Nothing's changed in that respect, right? So the appearance of the leadership has changed in South Africa. Okay? That is a real change. You know, legal separation between the ethnic groups. Okay, yeah, that's changed. That's gone. You know, but you know, rule two was only put in so that rule one could take effect. Because in order for these people to have black faces in high places in South Africa, they had to change rule two. But the only thing that anybody's really talking about is, you know, rule one. You know, I mean, you know, this is pretty much a follow-up on, you know, to the last dispatch, what we were talking about here in terms of the left, the political left. That's like, you know, like a deer in the headlights, you know, that doesn't know what to do. They're standing in the middle of the road waiting to be struck by an oncoming vehicle. not knowing what to do. Here, Nelson Mandela is being ripped apart. I mean, well, look, we knew he was going to be insulted. You know, that's just the internet, and we're talking about Mandela. So, of course, there's going to be some bigots that they're going to be very loud, and they want everyone to know how tough they are. So, you know, they have to insult someone who can't defend themselves. And you know, and frankly, someone who really didn't give a damn about their existence anyway. You know, or at least shouldn't have. But, you know, it's really something to watch how white people in the United States, white people in Britain, white people in Canada, who never gave a fuck about Mandela, never gave a fuck about the ANC, never gave a fuck about the struggle, all of a sudden now, oh, well, you know, he was my hero. And like I said, coming from Barack Obama, it's, you know, it's nothing but resonated air. You know, what the hell does he mean that, you know, he was leading the struggle that, well, I mean, what is Obama trying to say now that he was part of that struggle? His father was a part of that struggle, but that's his only connection. What has Barack Obama done to free black people? Before he was president? And since he's been president of the U.S., what has Barack Obama done to empower the black man and woman anywhere in the world? He's done absolutely nothing. He has totally disenfranchised us from our land, from our cultures, from our sense of democracy, in terms of our right to speak up, to demand rights, to, you know, to demand human and social justice. You know, it takes a hell of a lot of, you know, unmitigated gall to get before a microphone and to put out a statement and say that you were down with what Mandela was about. You are awarded a Peace Prize, which we all means nothing. I knew when I was young that the Peace Prize didn't mean a fucking thing when it was given to Henry Kissinger. Because if you remember, the Vietnamese diplomat in which he was supposed to share the prize said, "The hell, I'm not picking that up. I don't accept it." He goes, "There's no peace in my country. How can I accept the Peace Prize? There's no peace in my country." So, you know, the fact that Henry Kissinger, as evil as he is, was given a Peace Prize. You know, I mean, Alfred Nobel, you know, the entire Peace Prize, anything, you know, it comes out of war. So it's like, what the hell are we talking about here? And the entire time Obama was standing up there, he didn't make a Mandela speech. He gave a speech about, you know, how war was good. How war was necessary, right? And the only bad thing about war is not planning it correctly. Now, how many infants, how many children, how many grandmothers, how many innocent people have been wiped out and turned into, you know, red mist by drones? And now that red mist is mixing with the red dirt of Africa. Drones. Mercenaries. We find out now that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. agency, has an office in Africa. Well, I suppose they have several. You know, how does this work? Because when they had that recent mall attack, they were there. They were on the scene. So were the Israelis. What are they doing there? Israel has no business. It has no moral right to be in Africa. Now, I know a lot of people who are knowledgeable will point to their support for Idi Amin and the fact that they developed his air force and they trained many of his special forces. This is true. But who were they working with before they got to Idi Amin? The Israelis were in South Africa. They sent troops twice to, you know, quell, you know, what Mandela was trying to do in South Africa. You know, there were rebellions in the townships. Stanleyville was one of them, right? right? We're talking about the 60s now. We're talking about the 70s. We're talking about, you know, Rolf Steiner. Huh? Blackjack Schramm, right? Bob Denard. Mad Mike Hall. Fifth Commando. Huh? What are we really talking about? What are we really talking about when we talk about, oh, well, we were always with this movement. We were always supportive of this movement. The New York Times admits this. It was the Central Intelligence Agency, according to their reportage, that turned Brother Mandela in to the South African police, that turned him into BOSS, the Office of State Security. The thugs that did in, you know, who? Stephen Biko? I mean, how many names do we not know? Do we not remember? People who disappeared because of Boss. People who disappeared because of Belgian influence, because of Israeli influence, because of American influence, because of UK influence. I mean, like David Cameron. David Cameron used to belong to a conservative group of students that was calling for the execution of Mandela. Today, yesterday, he's in the press saying that Mandela was his hero. Mandela was his shining light. That's a lie. I'm watching Julia Gillard, you know, used to be leader in Down Under over in Australia, and she's talking about, oh, he was this bright light. While she stomped on the Aboriginal people, while she stomped on black people, she's talking about Nelson Mandela. And like I said, when we go back to Obama, I mean, what are we really talking about here? Mass incarceration, stop and frisk, huh? We're talking about, you know, white supremacist groups, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, who keeps track of these things, in excess of 400% they've risen since he's been in office. What has he done to address them? Nothing. This is a threat to African people. What has he done to deal with it? Absolutely nothing. We're supposed to believe that somebody who was inspired, or who claims to have been inspired by Nelson Mandela, will sit on his keister in a position of power with his Justice Department and allow black men and women to be executed every 28 hours on average. Read the report. Don't believe me. The Malcolm X grassroots movement. I know white supremacists can't get past Malcolm X grassroots movement. They know nothing about Malcolm X. Just like they know nothing about Nelson Mandela. Nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. They know nothing about Malcolm X, and they know nothing about Mandela. These are the same people who, you know, were out here talking about how, you know, these are the same people talking about how, you know, there's going to be this mass white kill-off after Mandela passes away. I haven't seen any reports, have you? Did it start yet? You know, I mean, these are the people pushing the hype out here, pushing the fear, because they're scared. Because they know how they would react if everything was reversed. You know, I'm just going to be frank with you. I mean, other than, you know, really complaining about it, you know, I mean, what else is to be said? You know, what else can be done? Very little. You know, because Obama's going to say what he's going to say, and Cameron's going to say what he's going to say, and Gillard's going to say what she's going to say, and Sarkozy is going to say what, you know, what the fuck he's going to say. Somebody, I mean, Sarkozy, I mean, he's a perfect example. It is against the law now in France to say that French colonialism was bad. It's against the law. Why is it against the law to say that French colonialism was bad? Why not just be honest and talk about the actual record? Well, see, the French are like, hell no, we can't do that. Can't do that. So it's against the law to discuss what the hell really went down with the French in Africa, right? I mean, think of the names of some of those mercenaries I just mentioned, like Bob Denard. I mean, who do you think he was working for? You think the French didn't know what the hell he was doing in Africa? I mean, you know, he was a freelancer. He worked for whomever. You know, he decided who he wanted to do. But they knew exactly what the hell he was doing. And in the 60s and 70s, he did it with their blessing, if not their orders. Meaning, they hired him to do these specific jobs, and he could have said yes or no on whether or not he took them. So, you know, let's not, you know, I mean, Rolf Steiner, his whole bit was to stop communism, you know, right? You know, you got to stop communism in Africa, because communism will come around and it'll just take all the freedom and everything. But, you know, because it's better to have places like Rhodesia. It's better to have white-ruled Mozambique, right? It's better to have the white minority government in the Republic of South Africa. You know, it's not logical to have black people make their own decisions about their own continent after the scramble for Africa in 1800s and then the second rape of Africa in which these men were involved in. And now we're looking at the third rape of Africa. Now, you know, they couldn't have done this if a white person was in office. I mean, everything that's going on in terms of surveillance and in terms of these drones and in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan, in terms of the invasions, you know, the whole Vietnam syndrome, right? That Pappy Bush says was licked through a aggressive amount of propaganda, of media complicity with lies. I mean, after Iran-Contra, you would think that no president, that no administration, regardless of party affiliation, will be able to do what Bush the second did, Bush the younger, but he managed to do it. Well, he didn't do anything really. I mean, let's just point this out. You know, Dick Cheney was running the goddamn government the entire time they were in office there. You know, I mean, Bush, I don't think he knew what the hell was going on. And I still don't believe that he fully knew what the hell was going on. But while he's painting cats down there in Texas, the Crawford coward who never served a day in the goddamn military. Right? Because if he did, he didn't show up. And we all know that he didn't show up. Because if he showed up, he'd have to give up some piss. And then he would have been, what? You know, dishonorable, court martial. We don't know what would have happened to him. But he certainly wouldn't have, walked around the way he did. You know, I mean, we know full well that he didn't do anything. But, you know, Bush W. is a fig. You know, we all goddamn know this. Out of all the Bush brothers, he is the biggest goddamn embarrassment to that family. And, you know, it is what it is. So, you know, we need to accept that Cheney, the same one who lobbied to keep Mandela on the terrorist watch list for as long as goddamn possible. I mean, they only took him off in 2008. It's 2013. You do the math. They didn't take him off the list until 2008, a little bit before his birthday. You know, I guess as a favor, right? You know, like when they released Marissa Alexander before Thanksgiving. You know, that was to save face for the court, for the system. Wasn't because, oh yeah, well, we're going to do justice here. They did that to look better for themselves, so when this thing gets to trial, the public doesn't have as much animosity towards them, and many of you on the left will fall for it. You will be grateful and you will thank them for letting her go so that she could spend Thanksgiving with her family instead of demanding that she had no business being in the goddamn first place, because the law in place says that she had a reason and a legal right to do what she did, especially when no one was hurt. She was trying to defend herself and her family. What was Zimmerman doing when he ran up behind somebody that he was tailing after he was told by the authorities not to engage with this person, right? But we heard it on the tape. You heard it, and I heard it on the 911 communication. Can't let these guys get away. These guys always get away. What isn't that what he said? Something to that effect? These people always get away, these folks. That he had to do this, right? He was on a mission from God to stop Trayvon Martin, right? Who we see described in the press as a thug and what have you. And what does Obama say about this? Well, he could have been my son. He looks like he could have been my son. And then, as usual, tore another rectum into the black community by telling us that, you know, we're lazy and that, you know, Trayvon Martin, basically these things happen because we're not doing enough, right? You know, we're not doing enough. We're not kissing enough white ass like he is. Yeah, I mean, this is what Dinesh D'Souza says, that we, people of color in the United States, owe white people everything. You know, we're talking about somebody who came from a very colonialized part of India, right? Raised a Christian from to begin with. He was raised to believe that he was better than the other people in his country because he was much more Europocentric than they were. Huh? Right? Who immigrates to the United States because of all of the benefits that he was able to pull in India, because poor people don't come over here unless they're being used as slaves, you dig? Somebody has to sponsor you. So he came over here and was allowed to go to the better schools because he kissed a lot of ass. And, you know, he went out of his way to become American. I mean, he went to the point of marrying somebody named Dixie Brubaker. I mean, you can't get too much more Uncle Goddamn Tom than that psychologically when you go out of your way to marry somebody blonde. It looks like they were on one of these PAX television shows with what do you call them, Lupe? The shoulder pads and what have you, right? Looking like one of these women on one of these church shows. Well, Pox is a Christian channel, right? Pox, right? So, you know, he went out of his way. You know, he pushing Christianity, pushing capitalism, the free market nonsense. He was one of the people that was supportive of Charles Murray and can't remember the other cat's name and don't really care, from the bell curve. You know, Africans are just genetically stupid, right? Because, you know, he's not a person of color. You know, he's just one of these advanced brown people. He's really a white man inside. I mean, this is what he believes. Alan West? I can imagine what Alan West is saying right now about Mandela. You know, Michael Steele of the RNC, Michael West, Shelby Steele. They're all probably trying to piggyback right now on what Bill O'Reilly is saying. Well, he was a communist, you know, we can't forget that, but he was a good one. You know, all kinds of this, you know, nutty crapola. And then, like I said, you got on top of it just pure racism. But what really irks me, and what really should be irking you, brother and sister, is the, we saw this coming. We knew it was going to happen. They did it to Dr. King. And now they're doing it to Mandela. They're trying to push him off as this peacenik who just allowed white people to spit on him, piss on him, call him a kaffir, right? And, you know, put him in the joint and take all of his best years from him because he loved white people so much that he was just unwilling to do anything to white people. And that was the concession that he made to go to prison, to do 30 some odd years and, you know, however long it was, because he loved white people, because he wanted to teach us a lesson about morality. And about how to love your enemy and so on. You know, one person so far has already quit me, blocked me on Twitter because I made it clear to him, and I wasn't alone in this, that Mandela is our hero, not yours. He didn't come to save white people. White people didn't need saving. He came to save us. He came for our liberation, not yours. So this white person got mad and now doesn't want to associate with me, and that's totally fine. Don't. And anyone else that follows me on Twitter, at The Angry Indian on Twitter, go right ahead. You know, go right ahead. If you don't like what I'm saying, hey, you know, you don't have to follow. You don't have to listen to the show. But for the rest of us, you know, we need to put these people in check. And this is what the last show was about. Now, I didn't know that brother was going to pass. I mean, nobody saw that coming. But the analysis is the same, and I stand on it. When it comes to the Redskins, no. You know, I'm not going to respect the fact that these men were native cold talkers and they stood there and allowed themselves to be debased. No, I'm not going to respect that. And I'm not going to respect any white man that's going to come to me and try to reconfigure Nelson Mandela as some wilting flower who, you know, who sacrificed everything that he did, that everything that he gave his entire life, you know, so white people could be protected. Now, I mean, you know, you got to consider the fact, especially if you're an Afrocentric thinker, that it was pretty obvious that when he got out of the system, he did everything he could to prevent a bloodbath. And he made what were called extraordinary concessions in order to make this possible. Now, you know, I'm not going to sit here like many in the RGB group who are just really talking out of their rectums. About that, oh, this should have been, you know, all this retribution. No, that's not what the movement was about. And if you don't understand that, then you need to get out of this movement. You know, it's not about hating white people. It's about hating oppression. But see, white folks would take that and they run with it. Just like Desmond Tutu. I remember people tried to call me out on this. So, well, you have no right to criticize Desmond Tutu. Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. When he brought them over there for, what was it, Lupe? Was it the World Cup? It was something. And, I think it was the World Cup. It was football, right? So, you know, all these people flooded over so they could see the World Cup. And he's like, you know, to the world community, welcome home. Because Africa's the home of humanity. Well, see, why say something like that? Tutu. I mean, come on, man. Why? Why do that? White people hear that and then it's like, oh, that's right. We have a right to now come in. We have a right to take over. We have a right to take land because you can't deny us. We have a right to be here. You're being racist to us as if we're white if we don't have a right to be here and to tell you what to do. You know, it's like I told you, I get into debates here with people talking about the Indians. I'm like, what do you mean you're Indian? Because you go to a drumming circle once every fortnight? So you're native now? So you go through the same prejudice that I do? You know, save that, man. Save that, roll it up into a nice little package, and stick it right up your lily white bigoted goddamn ass. Because, you know, that's, I don't want to hear that. No African who has any kind of goddamn gumption is going to sit there, stand there, and allow somebody white to sit and tell you that. You know, that's bullshit. That's bullshit. That's colonialist bullshit. You know, and you white, you know, cats on the left, man, you know, sisters for that matter, you know, you want to talk that nonsense, you know,
Just get out of the way and allow some other white people who are not full of shit to come in and take your place. Because you're wasting my goddamn time. You know, somebody like Rachel Corrie would look at you. I feel I can say this, like a fool. Or how about Lori Berenson? You know, people forget about her. People forget about Lori Berenson down there in Peru. You know, now the Bill Clinton, who's up here talking about Mandela all day long, about how he inspired him, certainly didn't do much to help Lori Berenson when she got into trouble. Do we really even know exactly what the hell happened? She copped on to certain charges because, well, she couldn't even see the judges, the faces of the military judges that put her in. And they still won't let her leave the country. So it's like, nah, man, you know, this, you know, she was down there supporting what? A liberation movement, right? An indigenous liberation movement, right? Now, before some other sucker tries to take me out of context, and the interview that you're going to hear following this with journalist Adam Hudson, you know, don't take me out of context. I don't, you know, if you've been following this podcast for any period of time or anything I've written, I don't support violence. And self-defense is not violence. You know, if somebody's trying to hit you and you put your arms up to prevent them from hitting you in the face, from hitting you in the ear, what have you, punching your eyes out. So what is that, violence? Because you're trying to protect yourself from an attack? No. See, we've been, and we're watching this with Mandela now, that the self-defensive struggle against the violence of the South African police, that I have to point out, was more than 90% black, indigenous black Africans, led by white officers. Same thing when you hear about these mercenaries. I mean, you know, maybe at the most, you'd probably have a unit of white mercenaries that numbered about 60. Maybe. And that's if they could get their own goddamn shit together, you know. But that was rare, and that was usually only when there was, you know, it was pretty clear that there was some European government, you know, or some European colonialist government, Euro settler government, that was backing what the hell they were doing. Because normally it would be, you know, anywhere from like, what, 5 to 18, maybe, white men from all over Europe that would go to these locations, side with one rebel group or another goddamn rebel group. I mean, there's a lot of talk about how they went back and forth, but that's not really true. You know, if you can point a white mercenary to me that supported a communist / left-wing movement in Africa, I'd like to see the data, because I'm not aware of any. Poor, Denard, Schramm, Steiner, all of them were anti-communist, anti-left-wing, and were pro-white. You know, they might have had some kind of liking or affinity for black people, provided that they stayed in their place. But, you know, I've read, you know, comments and statements from, you know, Portuguese mercenaries, Belgian mercenaries, to talk about how stupid the blacks were, how stupid the black soldiers were, how useless they were, how they basically were using them as pawns, you know. So, no. You know, anybody who wants to talk about Mandela, you have to talk about what was happening in Africa in the 1800s with the first scramble for Africa, where the European nations decided to chop it up and, you know, divvy it out amongst themselves so that they didn't fight amongst themselves. The same thing they did in China. Right. You know, what was the Boxer Rebellion? 1900 what? I don't remember. But, you know, that's what finally, you know, got them out. And, of course, it was xenophobic, and it was nasty, and, you know, it was mean. But they had pushed these people to the brink. You don't insult people on a daily goddamn basis in their own country and insult their leader, their king, their queen, whatever. And really think these people, unless they're just complete kiss-asses, are going to be all right with you. They're just biding their time. They're just biding their time. They're just biding their time. Now, the type of reactionary violence that I'm mentioning, which I'm not talking about self-defense. You know, when you look at what the Haganah and the Irgun did with the King David Hotel, that wasn't self-defense. That was straight up goddamn terrorism, right? Well, when they assassinated Count Bernadotte, Benedict, Folk Benedict, you know, all of the damage that they were doing, and the fact that if you look at the Ankara papers,
the fact that Lehi, the Haganah to a lesser degree, but you know the Irgun and Lehi, you know definitely worked with the Nazis, had invited Nazis over to work out deals. Now, you know, Zionists would tell you all day long about al-Husseini, who was the Grand Mufti at that time, and about how he basically jumped ship because he hated the British so goddamn much, and went to the Balkans, raised a Muslim army there for Hitler. I mean, there's films and photographs, there's documents of their conversations. I mean, he was doing radio propaganda for them. They paid him a salary. You know, they paid him a salary. And he stayed in Europe after that, as far as I understand. But he was also part of a fascist leaning group. They were Arabs, but they were still fascist leaning, you know, far right in Palestine. And their beef with the British was just that. We want you out. And the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And that's what they did. But, you know, his role was significant. But, you know, this isn't exactly the same thing as a Jew inviting a Nazi after Kristallnacht. Right? Around the time of the Final Solution and shit, to, you know, while all this is being drawn up, to come over to Palestine and help figure out how they can work together. They knew what their doctrine was about. They knew what the Nazis' eugenic doctrine was about. They saw it happening. And they were still willing to do business with them. Now, I'm not going to put Mandela in this morass of political strangeness, but it needs to be pointed out that he made deals with the white South African government. He and Pik W. Botha worked out a deal that whites would not lose anything. You know, maybe some people get robbed or what have you, but you know, whites would not lose anything. We're not talking about Zimbabwe now. We're not talking about Mugabe, right? Who was at that time a straight up revolutionary, but he was also, as we see, a self-centered goddamn revolutionary. That cannot be said about Brother Mandela. You know, the question really is, was he thinking about white people too much in terms of peace? You know, they want to make him out to be a peacenik, and that's, you know, if you want to stretch it like that. But let's just say he gave a fuck more of a fuck about white people than they give a fuck about themselves. And he definitely thought more about white folks in terms of their well-being than white people in South Africa back then or today think or give a fuck about their African countrymen, their African fellow countrymen. They don't give a fuck about them. They never really did. And frankly, they never really will. Now, they're individuals, of course. But, you know, to say that, you know, that this one white man now speaks for everybody is, you know, that's a real bullshit problem that the left really needs to fucking get off, you know, really needs to go see somebody about and lay on the couch and explain to that psychiatrist, that therapist, why one good deed somehow from a white person wipes out all of the damage that white people have been doing throughout the centuries. Because you have to be crazy to accept that as a logical way of looking at it. Because it's an illogical way of looking at things. John Robb, who was in China at the time of the rape of Nanjing, when the Japanese came through and destroyed, what, some say 600,000, some say, you know, 800,000, some say just a little shy of 1 million people, were raped, burned, tortured, shot on sight by the Japanese. They were just going berserk. And they had fun while they were doing it. And John Robb was a German. I forget what he was doing there, but he was in the Red Cross region where they set up an international zone where if the Japanese had come in there, it would have caused an international incident, which had brought the European powers, you know, into what they were doing. So they didn't want that. Not at that time, anyway. And he sent cables back to Germany directly to Hitler. Directly to the Reichstag and said, hey, man, you know, with the Führer find it in his heart to do something for these Chinese. And they sent two men from the Gestapo to speak to him directly. And they told him, do not send another fucking cable. We don't want to hear about this shit. Stay the fuck out of it. In fact, don't even mention goddamn Germany in this. You're acting as a private citizen. We don't know you. Now, he was a decent person, but he hated Jews. He was 100% behind the eugenics program of Nazi Germany, and he was cool with the idea of wiping out, Rom people, Turks, homosexuals, right? Christian Democrats, right? Social Democrats, all of the left, all of the communists, the communists just had to go, period, up against the wall, right? So, John Robb, Nazi. But here it is, he was, willing to do something humanistic for the Chinese, but or at least the Chinese that he knew personally, he gave a fuck about personally, because he had a direct connection with these people. Now, does that absolve the Nazi Party from what Hitler and Goebbels and Himmler and what have you were doing? I mean, Speer didn't really get he didn't get off. He got off lighter than the others, because he really was not connected to a lot of that. But they didn't let him just. I have his book in my office. It's thick. It took me like damn near 2 years to go through the entire thing. But he talks about what happened before and after, and how the banks were set up right the next goddamn day. So who was really come on. I mean, who did? We're talking about Nelson Mandela, according to the New York Times, being turned in by the Central Intelligence Agency, right? Is that true? Is it not true? It was reported in the Times. Is it true? William Bloom has said the same thing. Is it true? That's the speculation. I'm throwing it out of speculation. Is that true? But let's consider something. Who did the CIA hire first? When they went from OSS, right? And the executive, that little short 2 or 3 month thing before Truman signed that executive order that, created the agency. Who did, Wild Bill Donovan and Copeland and all of these cats, who did they hire? They hired Nazis. They hired Galen. They hired them right away. Without delay. They were anti-communist. They were supporting the Nazis beforehand. If they could have controlled Hitler, they would have continued to support him. Read the notes of Winston Churchill and read statements about how the U.S. wasn't doing a damn thing during the Blitz. Oh, yeah, they kept telling them, yeah, we know we're on your side. But they didn't do a goddamn thing. When the Nazis walked into France, they didn't do anything. What did they do? They didn't do anything. So, we need to look at this. And when we hear these pundits and politicians talk nonsense about how they respected Mandela and they respect what he was, what he was always for and his struggle and what have you, it's a lie. It's a lie, brothers and sisters. And it's time to wake up and, be honest about the fact that these people have never given a fuck about any of us. They had Jay Johnson here from the Defense Department go up and say that Reverend Martin Luther King, that he would have supported the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. They had the nerve to put out a statement saying that in speeches and about how proud he was to say this. And now he's he's in charge of the drone thing, right? Or at least he's the person that they want to put in charge. And so, he's working for Obama. He did under the aegis of Obama's policies. So it's like, how can Obama talk about Mandela? How can David Cameron talk about Mandela? Well, what he's doing to the poor with austerity. Sarkozy can't say anything. Hollande can't say anything. Gillard can't say anything. Rudd can't say anything. You think Tony Abbott is going to say anything of any value to this? Not one of these world leaders. The only person that could have really said, the only person that has any right to say anything today is Maduro in Venezuela and Ecuador. These are the only people. These are the only people. Those are the only two countries that I can think of off the top of my head to have any reason and any legitimacy. And Cuba, Cuba, Venezuela, that's it. That's it. Bolivia, outside of Latin America, who is in a position? The Arab world, the Saudis don't have a goddamn thing to say. United Arab Emirates, they don't have anything to say. Egypt shouldn't say a word. Not after what just happened. Not after what's been happening. We would have loved to have heard from Brother Gaddafi, being he actually supported the liberation movement, but we saw what happened to him, right? And we saw, and what we heard, what Hillary Clinton said about that.
But many of you on the left are going to vote for her anyway. Many of you on the left were crying when you heard Obama say what he said. I'm just going to tell you, you know, you're stupid. You're stupid to see what's going on and to not want to accept the reality of the conditions that you were in. They cannot talk about Nelson Mandela like this while you have every 28 hours going on. Mass incarceration going on. Stop and frisk going on. You know, the reinvasion, the third rape of Africa going on as we are speaking here. We have we have all of these new revelations from WikiLeaks, from Chelsea Manning, right? I mean, these are their documents. This isn't speculation. These are their documents. And when we look at the collateral murder video, you know, the whole point, the whole reason that Chelsea Manning is in the position that she's in right now, and we see what happened, and the fact that the men who did this were given awards for this. And you want to talk about Mandela? How can you talk about Mandela? You can't talk about Mandela and support that. That's impossible. It's impossible. You can't. You can't. They are diametrically opposed. You cannot. And the left needs to understand this. And the black man and woman in the world needs to accept it. You were never, ever, ever liked. And you will never, ever get respect if you continue to come around and beg for scraps from these people. Individual white people are not your oppressors. But white folks as a group have continued to oppress us and will continue to oppress us until we start to understand and speak that truth. And just running your mouth and getting angry at white people and calling them names, that's nothing. That's stupid. And if you come around with me like that, I'm going to let you. Because that's not what it's about. That individual white person is caught up in the system just as much as you are. What we need to do is educate that white brother and sister to what the fuck is really going on. And to understand and accept that people like Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King, that people like Stephen Biko, that people like Malcolm X, and that people like Mandela belong to us. They belong to us. I would never expect the Chinese community to give up their heroes. I would never expect the Jewish community to give up its heroes. But, you know, Native Americans, right? African people, well, indigenous people anywhere in the world, we're supposed to give up our heroes and allow the white marketplace to twist them and take them completely out of goddamn context. Now, it's bad when we take them and make them mythological, you know, creatures. When we're not realistic. And come up with all kinds of nonsense to the point where, you know, these people were perfect and they could fly. No, see, that's just as dumb, and we have to be careful about that too. But we cannot continue to go on allowing our oppressors to write our stories and to tell our stories and to reconfigure our stories for their uses. Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, if you're familiar with American media, they already started this. And they got their leads from the politicians. I mean, Ted Cruz is out here. Ted Cruz. Ted, I was born in Canada, and I'm trying to be a Spanish-speaking version, or the Cuban version, basically. I'm trying to be the Canadian-Cuban version of tail gunner Joe McCarthy, right? You know, who talked about communists all over the goddamn place, you know, when he could put his whiskey bottle back in his briefcase. And tried to, you know, pretend that he was doing some business. Where was it? In Wheeler, Virginia, I think it was, where he whipped out that number of whatever it was, 140, whatever the number was, because he didn't remember, because he kept going up and down depending on who he was talking to, how much trouble he was in, you know, in terms of being able to prove his allegations. You know, well that was Roy Cohn's job, right? That was Roy Cohn and David Shine's job, I suppose, to, you know, cover all that up and make it seem like something was happening. You know, like John Yoo. You know, to totally excuse and explain away the inexcusable and things that should never be explained away. Especially when you're trying to talk with a straight face about Mandela, who stood for everything that these people are out here, you know. I mean, he stood for everything these people are out here trying to do and have been doing. So, no, yeah, I don't like that type of hypocrisy. And if you have any common sense, you wouldn't either. So we're going to take a break here so stations may identify themselves. And when we come back, we're going to have an interview about this subject, about the recent passing of Mandela and what this really means politically for the African diaspora and for the political slash progressive left in general, at least in the United States. We're going to talk about this. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
African nationalism has only made itself felt in campaigns of non-cooperation. Where there have been riots in locations like these, they've generally been caused by bad conditions. 2 days before South Africa became a republic, a stay-away strike was organized throughout the country in protest. But most Africans went to work. 10,000 of them were arrested before the strike began. The army was fully mobilized, and an African knows he can be jailed for 3 years if he dares to strike. I went to see the man who organized this stay-away, a 42-year-old African lawyer, Nelson Mandela, the most dynamic leader in South Africa today. The police were hunting for him at the time, but African nationalists had arranged for me to meet him at his hideout. He is still underground. This is Mandela's first television interview. I asked him what it was that the African really wanted.
The Africans, with fire, want franchise. Basis of one man, one vote. They want political independence.
Do you see Africans being able to develop in this country without the European being pushed out?
We have made it very clear in our policy that South Africa is a country of many races. There is room for all the various races in this country.
Are there many educated Africans in South Africa?
Yes. We have a large number of Africans who are educated and who are taking part in the political struggles of the Africa. The question of education has nothing to do with the question of the vote. On numerous occasions, it has been proved in history that people can enjoy the vote even if they have no education. Of course, we desire education and we think it's a good thing. But you don't have to have education in order to know that you want certain fundamental rights, you have got aspirations, you have got claims. It has nothing to do with education whatsoever.
Are you planning any more campaigns of non-cooperation?
Yes. The Peter Marisbeck resolution makes provision for campaign of non-cooperation with the government. And we are presently studying plans to implement this aspect of the resolution.
Now, if Dr. Verwoerd's government doesn't give you the kind of concessions that you want sometime soon, is there any likelihood of violence?
There are many people who feel that the reaction of the government to our stay at home, ordering a general mobilization, arming the white community, arresting 10,000 of Africans, the show of force throughout the country, notwithstanding our clear declaration that this campaign is being run on peaceful and non-binding lines, close the chapter as far as our methods of political struggle are concerned. There are many people who feel that it is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and non-violence against the government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people. And I think the time has come for us to consider, in the light of our experiences in this stay at home, whether the methods which we have applied so far are adequate.
Thank you. Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Oh, brightens the day for you. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginals.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power of making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Every day, one more Aboriginal person will test positive for HIV. Some will be rejected by their family, friends, and community. They will live in isolation, their voices no longer heard. HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination denies our people the right to protect their future. You can make a difference. Be their voice. End HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination. Get information from your community health center or nursing station, or visit www.caan.ca.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying? For Men in Hip Hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable, you know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about, it shouldn't be supported, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her, and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
Este es Radio Insurgente, voz del Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, transmitiendo desde las montañas del sureste mexicano.
Voices Indigenous Radio brings to you the basics of how not to violate the law and presents the people who are fighting the war against Mother Earth. We bring the awareness of a different paradigm to the airwaves of WBAI as we shed the same old systematic paradigm that is killing Mother Earth. And you can hear the perspective of Indigenous peoples throughout the world and how they live with the law, land, air, and water. First Voices Indigenous Radio is produced in the studios of WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming and archived on WBAI.org and First Voices Indigenous Radio.org.
This is APNS Public Radio.
The opinions expressed in dispatches represent the analysis of the participating editors and may not necessarily reflect the group positions of the ANG or its public news wires.
I think Angry Indian is one of those people who likes to walk up to two guys and say, "Let's see you and him fight."
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is the Angry Indian, and you know, we're not happy here. We're not happy over here at the Aboriginal News Group. Mandika has transitioned. And if you're a African anywhere in the diaspora, I don't care where you are in the diaspora. I mean, even you really questionable black Republicans in the U.S. and you black Tories in Canada and the U.K. I mean, if you're not asking yourself certain questions right now through tears, then I really question your integrity. I really do. Brother Mandela stood for something. And while he was languishing in the white man's prison over there, Robben Island, you know, there was a lot of people over here in the States that were saying that he deserved to be in there. You know, Ronald Reagan, Pappy Bush. You know, there were a lot of people who said he deserved to be in there. And I don't remember Clinton saying too much when he was there. So, you know, Republican, Democrat, it really doesn't matter, does it? And David Cameron is now out there making speeches about how he cared and how he respected Mandela, even though he was part of a group of conservative students that put out a poster talking about Mandela should have been hung, that he should have been sent to the gallows for standing against white power in South Africa. I mean, how many politicians here? I remember my pops, man. You know, my own father, he was disgusted with, what was he out there in Lynchburg? Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, who was no longer on this mortal coil, you know, who talked about how great South Africa was. And the Reverend Jimmy Swaggart, before he was embarrassed, talking about how great South Africa was. And it should be exactly the same thing here. So now the entire white political world wants to jump up and talk about how much they praised and loved Brother Nelson Mandela, while they worked against everything Brother Nelson Mandela was trying to do, what he stood for, what he represented, and he, as an individual, they worked against him. The powers that be worked against the African National Congress and their leader, right? Because if you get rid of the head, the snake will just wither, right? They worked against him, and now they're out here doing boilerplate propaganda as if they care, that they were supportive of the struggle of black people in South Africa against a vicious, oppressive, xenophobic state. And obviously a lot of people of color are out there going for this. A lot of Africans obviously are buying this. Especially since Barack Obama has decided to talk about how, you know, Mandela has inspired him. You know, this is somebody who won the Peace Prize, but yet he, in his entire speech at the Nobel Committee, talked about legitimate war. And you know, Gaddafi. What happened to Gaddafi? Gaddafi was a personal friend of Nelson Mandela for a reason. For a reason. Now, I can go on for about 6 hours, 7 hours, talking about Brother Nelson Mandela and the hypocrisy of this. But we're going to speak to Adam Hudson right now. He's an independent journalist, freelance. He's a contributing editor when he's allowed to get a break. Dig what I'm saying? He covers war, human rights, you know, Gitmo. I mean, you know, racism, post-colonialism, racism, pre-colonialism, right? You know, post-colonial. I mean, are we post-colonial while we're talking about Mandela? I mean, that's a goddamn question. Mm-hmm. That's a goddamn question. You know, he's an alumni at Stanford. And from what I can see here, he drummed, you know. So let's give the man some respect. He's been printed in Truthout, Alternate, The Nation. Adam Hudson, welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
All right. So look, man, you know, I mean, this is a day that for the black man on planet Earth that, you know, is a day of sadness. I mean, we're all mourning. In our sadness, you know, we're hearing a lot of hypocrisy out here from a lot of world leaders. I mean, what is your opinion on this? As a black man in America, and as a journalist who covers human rights issues, you've been around the world on this. You know, how do we define this as a demographic, you know, as a group? You know, how do we define this hypocrisy in terms of what Mandela stood for, what he lived for, what he fought for, what he suffered under? That now he's being pushed off as a black Gandhi as opposed to the real freedom fighter that he actually was.
Yeah, I think there's a clear disconnect between what he stood for, what he fought for, particularly 27 years in prison, that with the leaders who are praising him, and also the records of the leaders who are praising him. So you brought up Obama, for example. Well, okay, well, let's look at what Obama's done, and let's match that up with like what Mandela fought against. We've seen an expansion of drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. We see the continuing practice of indefinite detention without trial of dozens over 100 people, and not even just places like Guantanamo, but even Bagram in Afghanistan. He's continued that. He's waged an unprecedented war on whistleblowers and journalists. He's continued the war in Afghanistan. They say he says he's going to try to pull out in 2014, but this latest deal that they're trying to get Karzai to sign is basically going to leave U.S. troops, particularly U.S. Special Operations Forces, in Afghanistan in perpetuity, at least until 2024. We've seen basically the expansion of the U.S. war machine around the world under Obama, and also the continuing suffering of black people in America under austerity and neoliberal policies. One would be the efforts to gut Social Security, which is something that is being championed by both Democrats and Republicans, despite the spin that's on the mainstream media. So you see that happening under this administration. And then you compare that to what Mandela fought against, particularly before he got in power. I think there's a clear contradiction. So yeah, I think hypocrisy is a great way to put it, because if Mandela were still alive today, or if he were, if Mandela were fighting the way he was fighting years ago today, those same leaders would not be praising him. They would be condemning him. They'd be calling him a terrorist. Dick Cheney supported keeping Mandela on the terrorist list up until 2008, which is when he and the ANC got off the terrorist list. These leaders who are currently praising him, they'd be singing a different tune if Mandela were still alive. And also keep in mind that Mandela explicitly called out the State of Israel and criticized it for its racist treatment of Palestinians and called it apartheid, and compared the practices of Israel's treatment of Palestinians to apartheid in South Africa. But compared that to the U.S. government, which is giving Israel $3 billion in military aid every year, which gets used to oppress Palestinians. So that's not a clear contradiction right there. So yeah, I think hypocrisy is a great way to put it, because those leaders would not be praising him if Mandela were still alive today and were still engaged in the sorts of very militant action that he was involved with when he fought against South African apartheid.
Yeah, now there's a lot of discussion about the role of nonviolence and the role of violence in terms
right.
of the African National Congress in this struggle. There is no doubt, no one disputes the fact that the Soviet Union, that Communist China, at least under Mao, supported him, and the ANC at this time. There is no doubt that Libya, Gaddafi, did much to support the African National Congress at this time. And there is no doubt, and there is no real debate, that the ANC led an armed struggle. But,
right.
you know, what is the difference between armed struggle as opposed to terrorist violence?
Right, that's a good question. I think the term terrorism, I don't like to use the term, particularly now, because it's been so politicized to the point where it almost doesn't mean much. But I think clearly it means like, you know, politically motivated violence against civilians, which is wrong in any case. I don't support terrorism no matter who is committed by it. But the term terrorism has been so politicized that it gets used usually against certain designated political enemies. So someone like Mandela gets considered a terrorist, whereas like what about state terrorism by like, let's say, the United States or Israeli government, the shock and awe campaign in Iraq in 2003, that closely fits the bill of the definition of terrorism, but it doesn't get called that because it's the U.S. government doing it. So therefore, like, okay, it's not terrorism. It's we're fighting for democracy. Find some other term to describe it. So that's why I hate using the term terrorism, because it all depends on like who's doing it and you know who's doing it and who hates the person doing it. So, but armed struggle, I'm not opposed to armed struggle, but I do think that we shouldn't lionize armed struggle as well, because I think there's a tendency, even on the left, particularly the radical left, to totally lionize and glamorize armed struggle, which I think, as you and I were talking about beforehand, it can get pretty ugly. And so it's not something that should be treated as like, yeah, armed struggle is totally great and we should just do it because, you know, we're right. There is a difference between rebel groups fighting against an oppressive government and an oppressive government using violence to oppress people. I think there's a clear difference. And for that, like when people who are resisting against oppression use violence because they feel that's the only way that they can achieve their freedom, I see legitimacy of that. But my issue is like when it goes too far, and sometimes it does. And I think, you know, we have to be a little nuanced in our understanding of it, like treat armed struggle of people who are oppressed as legitimate, but at the same time, like, don't go overboard in the way of like, okay, now we can just kill whoever we want because we're trying to struggle for freedom. We shouldn't go that far either. So my main thing is like violence being used as a tool to oppress people and a tool for liberation, and I think that's kind of where I somewhat differentiate it. But at the same time, like, I prefer nonviolence. I'll just say that. I prefer nonviolence. I think that's the better way to go, because violence, when you employ it, it does lead to, even from a radical perspective or a progressive perspective or a revolutionary perspective, it can lead to unintended consequences that I think even the people employing it would regret. Like, I'd have a hard time, like, supporting the notion of, like, killing innocent babies or any innocent civilian in the name of like whatever supposed radical utopia anyone wants to put out there that I would probably agree with. That's where I kind of draw lines. Like, look, I don't think that we should be killing like innocent people just because like we think it's going to get us liberation. I think that's, we have to draw the line somewhere, even if you're employing violence.
Well, yeah, I mean, we talked about this, you know, in our warm up, you know, for this dispatch, that, you know, for those of you who remember the late Reverend Khalid Abdul Muhammad, I mean, he made some ridiculous, and we're going to try to add some of that audio so there's some context. He made a ridiculous call that all white people should be, you know, just wiped out, should be murdered on sight in South Africa when the ANC takes over. You know, thankfully, no one really, you know, listened to that type of thing. I mean, that was less than 1% of the African diaspora that was discussing that sort of, you know, that sort of sentiment. You know, nothing happened. And I feel that that has to do a lot with Mandela, the quality of the struggle that they were engaged in, the educational level of the African National Congress, the discipline that they had politically, the discipline that was extended to from Joe Slovo and the rest of the armed resistance, that it was just that. It was armed resistance. It was self-defense. It was not an anti-white movement. People forget that how many Boers, how many British, how many Jews in South Africa were involved in the anti-apartheid struggle. And they were defending themselves. They were not looking to remove white people from South Africa. They were not looking to punish white people in South Africa. And, you know, that really needs to be discussed. But, you know, I want to ask you before we take a quick break here, you know, when we see or read the statements of Barack Obama, when we read and hear the statements of David Cameron and his supposed connections to a conservative group of students in the UK who were calling for the execution of Nelson Mandela, you know, what goes through your mind as someone who covers human rights in terms of the political grandstanding that's happening right now in relation to this issue? And what this, you know, and how the African community, in terms of the actual diaspora, the entire diaspora, how we should really look and analyze the political fallout, if you will, in terms of phoniness behind this.
Yeah, I think it's when people like Cameron and Obama are doing, I think, as you rightfully pointed out, grandstanding, I think it's totally cynical, but in a way it's not that surprising. I'd honestly be more surprised if they weren't doing that grandstanding, because I think usually when after movements of liberation are successful, and including the movement against apartheid in South Africa, but you can also even look in the United States, the civil rights movement. After those movements are successful, what you tend to notice is like a tendency to basically whitewash the movement and the leaders of that movement. So Martin Luther King, I think, is a great example. I think looking at him, I think the way Mandela is being treated is the same way that Martin Luther King is being treated. So the way Martin Luther King is remembered is usually like, you know, nonviolence. The part in his I have a dream speech that like you're judged by the content of a character and not the color of your skin. Those sorts of messages that they selectively pick that from Dr. King because they're the less politically confrontational aspects of Dr. King's thinking, and then they say, okay, this is Dr. King and we all honor him. Like, they pick the stuff that of Dr. King that pretty much anyone can agree on, and then they chop it and water it down, and then they say, okay, this is Dr. King and this is how we remember him. But what doesn't get remembered about Dr. King was his stance against the Vietnam War, his support for workers' rights and labor rights. The day that he died, he was supporting the struggle of sanitation workers, of janitors, and he expanded his civil rights agenda to not just challenging legal segregation, but to also embrace economic equality and challenge economic forms of oppression that hurt Black people. So low wages, poverty, forms of like housing segregation, things like that. Like he was looking more at like tackling social and economic inequality. But people tend to forget that because he was even people who were allies of him were saying like, okay, Dr. King, you're going a little too far. And there were, you know, beforehand he was cool with like President Johnson in the White House, but then they're like, okay, Dr. King, you're going too far. And like he was at times like disinvited from the White House. But you rarely hear that about Dr. King today. People rarely talk about that, but he actually stood for that. And his speech against the Vietnam War, he called America the biggest purveyor of violence in the world today. But again, you don't hear that. And so I think pretty much the same thing is happening with Nelson Mandela, that now people can water down what he stood for and his legacy and his life and pretty much market him in a way that's not controversial and not confrontational. And so people are not going to talk about, like, you know, when Cameron was involved in a conservative student group that said that they wanted to hang Mandela and group members of the ANC. You're not going to hear about his support and involvement in armed struggle against apartheid. You're not going to hear that. You're going to hear stuff that's more watered down and kind of friendly and, like, you know, that appeases everyone and doesn't shake people up. So I think for people of color, particularly Black people, I think what we have to do is to basically tell the whole truth about these individuals, what they stood for, and the movements they supported. I think we have to tell the whole truth, if not to create further change, but just to basically have the history books written in a more honest way. I think that's at the minimum, should have the history books be written more clearly and more honest. If we're going to talk about Mandela, let's talk about his entire record and what he stood for. Same with Dr. King, same with Malcolm X, same with people like Fannie Lou Hamer, all the other freedom fighters who, you know, many of whom we don't think about, who probably aren't as famous as Dr. King. We have to tell the whole truth, so we have a full understanding of like what they stood for, what these moves were about, even where they failed, and how to move forward. So I think at the end of the day, we shouldn't get sucked into people like Obama and Cameron whitewashing the legacy of Mandela. We have to tell the whole truth about who he was and what he stood for.
Okay, we're speaking to Adam Hudson. He's a freelance journalist. He's been published in Truth Out, Alternate, The Nation. You can check out his personal work at adamhudson.org, and you can find him on Twitter the same way I did, AdamHudson5. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We'll be back. We're going to take a quick break so we can allow stations to identify themselves. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Zesh9 from Zesh9.com, and you're listening to the Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Go on, chillin'. That's what we're talking about. We need a little help. Can't do this y'all alone. Thank God for this. Lick. Jim Brown, y'all. Yes, this your evening. One more time. We the ask on the chillin' for get up. Get into it. Get involved. Oh, Hunter Chillin, when I have to come down here to the Gullah Geechee Nation, and so glad that Hunter to tune in to we Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio Station. Hunter Chillin, no, this year the head from the body of this year nation and the horse of we station. Queen Quest, come on, Chillin, get involved, get involved, get involved to the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition, the sponsor of this year radio station. Hunter Chillin, this year the we show, Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio. Come on, y'all.
I'm gonna stand until I can't stand no more if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो
थाहा छ सन् 1988 मा
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए कसले के गरे
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी बहन गर्यौं तपाईले गर्नुभयो
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं जिम्मेवारी बहन गरौं
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is Ed Asner. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, and tortured, targeted civilians, and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
This is Kristen Hirsch from Throwing Muses, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate niggers, we hate Jews, we hate faggots, and we hate specs. We don't have to have a reason to hate. People need to get off your ass and wake up. This is America.
With white people showing love like this, Who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
We kill the children, we kill the babies, we kill the blind, we kill the crippled, we kill the crazy, we kill the faggots, we kill the lesbians. I said, God damn it, we kill them all. He said, well, why kill them all? Why kill the women? First, why kill the babies? They're just little innocent blue-eyed babies. Because, God damn it, they're going to grow up one day to rule your babies. Kill them now. Why kill the women in South Africa? I said kill the women because the women are the military manufacturing center. And every 9 months they lay down on their backs and reinforcement rolls out from between their legs. So shut down the military manufacturing center by killing the white woman. Why kill the elder crackers? The old crepit crackers in South Africa. How in the hell you think they got old? They got old oppressing and killing black people.
Yes, sir.
I said, kill a cripple, kill a hell fall, kill a hog, God darling. Kill them all. Kill a faggot, kill a lesbian. And after you kill them all, I said that day about Mandela to let you know what he really knows about me. Don't know a damn thing. I said, then you go to the goddamn grave and dig them up and kill them a goddamn again. Because they didn't die hard enough. You don't have the strength to dig them up after you've done all that work. Just go to the grave and shoot in the damn grave. Kill them again. Because they didn't die hard enough. I don't have no respect for Mandela.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're speaking to freelance journalist Adam Hudson. You can find his work at adamhudson.org. You can find him on Twitter at adamhudson5. He's been publishing Truth Out, Alternate the Nation. He primarily speaks on the abuses and human tragedies of war and, you know, conflict, man. You know, I mean, exactly what we're talking about in terms of apartheid, in terms of the struggle against apartheid, in terms of the struggle against white rule in Rhodesia. And, you know, what I want to get into now are those contradictions, those paradoxes. Because I used to, like quite a few other, you know, somewhat Afrocentric, politically speaking people, I used to support Robert Mugabe. I cannot support Robert Mugabe now. Now, what happened in Rhodesia in terms of his struggle against Rhodesia, what happened in terms of Portugal, South Africa, and other countries, you can take your guess. Working with Zupa Zanu and what have you, you know, white people claiming to be fighting on behalf of the black people who were suffering under Mugabe. Those first 8 to 10 years under rule of Mugabe in what was returned in terms of the nomenclature, returning the name of Zimbabwe back to the people of Zimbabwe, you know, removing the taint of Cecil Rhodes, right? You know, here it is. They were okay. They had their struggles. But when he tried to pay off politically his cronies, the entire country went to seed. So when we look at what happened with Brother Mandela, there were meetings between Pik W. Botha, Mandela, representing the ANC, and whatever Zuma and the other people were doing at this time. And they came to an agreement. Mandela was released. They had an election. Of course he won. Everybody knew this was going to happen. It was just a foregone conclusion, a way to political gravity. Of course he was going to win. But Anglo-American is still in business. More than 90%, some say 96% of the arable land in South Africa is still owned by the same Europocentric concerns that were controlling it beforehand. Now, as I was talking with the brother before we got into the show, I find myself to be in a very strange political position because I find myself speaking up for Bolas, not these racist white supremacist, far right
people in South Africa. I'm talking about the average Boer who were the buffer class. You know, the police officers, the plumbers, you know, the small business owners, right? You know, I mean, they paid a price as Boers when the, you know, more Anglo, more British, you know, people started to fill in those particular gaps that were left over after they had to make room for a black buffer middle class. And that black buffer middle class has no problem not only stepping on the former Boer who were the middle class, you know, the people who basically did the dirty work in keeping Africans down, but they have no problem stepping on their brothers. So now we have Boers who are living in the townships right next to the same black people that they used to oppress. But we have black people in power, but we have black people who are really still disenfranchised. We have white folks who are still in power, but we have the ethnic white people, whereas many of us forget about the Boer War, who are now in the same position. You know, when are we going to start discussing these paradoxes in terms of Mandela? And why are we not hearing about this? And why have we not heard about this, Brother Hudson?
Yeah, sorry, I was wondering where you're going to go with the, if you're just going to talk and then have the question. But
well that is the question, actually. You know, it's yeah. Like, you know, why are we not raising these particular contradictions in terms of, you know, when we saw Mugabe get into power, why didn't he really do what the hell he needed to do? Now we see him trying to stay in power, even though he's not doing anything for anybody except himself. Right. And then we had Mandela and the ANC. And yes, they gave to their cronies. They gave to people who supported them politically. They gave and created a bit of a, you know, indigenous black middle class. But they've done nothing for the townships. The townships have not, they just don't continue to exist. They're still expanding. When did we discuss this? You know, the diamonds and the gold and the platinum and all of the other riches of South Africa have not trickled down to the people who really need it along the Transvaal.
Yeah, and I'm sure, as you know, like the Mandela making deals with the IMF and implementing structural adjustment policies in South Africa. I mean, that hasn't worked well in other parts of the world, particularly Latin America.
I mean, interrupt you, but work well for who? Because it certainly works well for the investors. It certainly works well for the people. Like, I can't remember his name right now. Oh, Cyril Ramaphosa, who was signing deals with the Oppenheimers while Mandela was still sitting in the joint. If I remember the way it was explained to me correctly, he was ANC.
Yeah.
But now I've seen photographs of him sitting with the Oppenheimers, having laughs, having, you know, drinking tea.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's that. Sadly, it's not an unfamiliar story. I mean, even in the U.S., you see a similar thing. I think two things. I think one, particularly now since Mandela died, I think there's been this push to kind of lionize him for an understandable reason, because he did a lot of very important things that you know, we should not dismiss. And I know that you would agree with me on this,
no doubt.
But at the same time. People don't want to talk too ill of him because he just passed away. But at the same time, I think we should resist that because now it is a good time to bring up the full account of what he did, not just his courageous fight against apartheid, which was important. I mean, anyone who stands up against a big, massive apartheid regime deserves some praise. But at the same time, like, Mandela did get elected into power. And he implemented policies, and we have to judge those policies based on, you know, who they helped and who they hurt. And so we shouldn't let the whole him passing away dissuade us from talking about that. Another thing, though, is like with particularly in the U.S. and with not just Obama, but even you can even say this of like even the Congressional Black Caucus.
With
Obama, like, what I've noticed is more so during his first term, to a lesser extent his second term now, but I say more so, especially his first term, there's been two ways, particularly progressive, not just progressives, but particularly black people. Amongst the progressive left in America, the way they've looked at Obama, is that they say, well, he's not perfect, but we have to protect him and his presidency from the Republicans and the Tea Party. And some of that I understand, because like if you look at the Tea Party and the Republicans, they're ultra far right racist. And I think it is true that like they will stop at nothing to block everything that he wants to do just because he's black. I think that's true. I don't argue against that at all. But the thing is like a lot of progressives will take that and then use that as an excuse to not talk about anything bad that he's done, particularly on foreign policy, which is where I think out of everything on his record, from like healthcare to the economy to other issues, foreign policy, I think, is where he's really, really doubled down on the Bush militarism of the previous couple of years. There's almost no difference between what Bush did in 8 years and what Obama's doing. The only real difference is that Obama is more reticent to do ground invasions than Bush was. Bush emphasized a lot of ground invasions, particularly with Iraq and Afghanistan. But Obama's critique on those wars, and I think this is really important, his critique wasn't that these wars were like illegal or they were immoral or they were inhumane or they were wrong on any sort of like humanistic level, or even that they were based, particularly the Iraq war, that it was based on lies. His critique was that it was a dumb war, namely that like strategically it was a bad idea. He has no problem with like the idea of the U.S. remaining the dominant hegemon, the dominant military power in the world. That's kind of that's a shared consensus between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to war policy. His thing was that that the invasions were bad for U.S. power, that they were bad strategically in terms of maximizing and projecting U.S. power. That was really his critique. So that's why he moved away from the ground invasion, because they were costly. They're strategically unwise, but he's doubled down more on these kill teams, the like JSOC special operations forces. He's relied a lot on like private military contractors to train proxy forces to engage in kill or capture operations, particularly in East Africa and particularly in Somalia. He's expanded the number of drone strikes and other airstrikes, particularly in Pakistan, increasing more so in Yemen. And also, it's been more underreported, but like in Africa too. I mean, the U.S., like, when it comes to our war on terror, we're shifting from the Middle East and more so to particularly the Horn of Africa, particularly Yemen and Somalia. And that's something I think that does not get mentioned enough, but I think it's going to become more and more relevant as the years go on. So these sorts of things, they tend to be downplayed when it comes to how progressives relate to Obama, because they don't want to bring that up, because they think if any criticism of Obama automatically helps Republicans, which I think is a terrible logic. You can criticize Republican policies and Obama wars at the same time, which I've done a lot. But I think you've noticed that, like a silencing, particularly on Obama's militarism, how he's pretty much continued almost everything that the Bush administration has done. And even like what I've done personally, like I spent 2 weeks in Guantanamo Bay reporting there, and what I saw on the ground is essentially the same policy. He wants to close it, but really his plan for closing Guantanamo amounts to transferring the practice of indefinite detention without trial from Guantanamo to somewhere else. That's really his plan to close it. And keep in mind that Guantanamo, there's a big U.S. military base that's been there for over 100 years. So, but that base is not going away. It's just a prison that we're having trouble closing. So on a lot of these things, he's continuing pretty much exactly where Bush left off. The reason why, and especially within the black community, there's been this, because he's the first black president, there is the added desire to want to protect him, because I think a lot of black Americans view the success of the Obama presidency with the success of the black community as a whole, which I don't agree with. And I think, as you were pointing out earlier, you can have black people in power, but still have oppression of black and other oppressed people. Even working class whites, or not even just, you know, blacks and whites, like the racial profile of Muslims and Arabs and South Asians in this country under the guise of the war on terror, that's been continuing under Obama. Deportations of Mexicans and other people from Latin America from this country, that's been continuing. So people, I think, in America are mistaken to view the election of a black president as some sort of symbolic progressive victory. I mean, it's only an improvement symbolically, but when it comes to actual policy, it's not much of a change. People get wrapped up in that symbolism of Obama, and I think that's why there's been more of a reluctance to criticize him, particularly on areas where he's been messing up. So that's why people, you know, are more, don't want to talk about drone strikes. Or actually, you know, it's even worse. It's even worse than that, because even you see amongst liberals, you see a lot of support for drone strikes amongst liberals, because Obama has pretty much sold it to them. There's a poll done like a year ago that said like somewhere around 60-70% of liberals support drone strikes. It's a huge number, but if it were done under Bush, they wouldn't be saying that. They would be criticizing if drone strikes and other war policies if it were Bush or Republican. Not even just Bush, maybe like if it were President McCain or Palin or, God forbid, Ted Cruz.
Oh, yeah, they certainly would have if it was McCain and Palin, you know, because they already had the opinion that these are two warmongers and they have white faces. So it would have fit into the, you know, evil white colonialist vulture capitalist thing. But see, but not as you've gone into this into this region, you know, we cannot leave here without discussing the terrorism aspect in terms of what's been happening recently now with Mandela. Now, as you have stated here, Dick Cheney was one of the people that was pretty much adamant that Mandela and the ANC had to remain on the terrorist watch list. Created and maintained by the U.S. and recognized by most of the Anglophone world and the United Nations, I suppose, that they recognize this as a litmus test. Here it is, we have the MEC from Iran, where we had prominent conservatives and some Democrats, ex-military people, who were paid to advocate and to push for them to be removed from the list, even though they have been antagonistic to U.S. interests and U.S. personnel over the years. Now, we have Asada Shakur in Cuba, who has been, because of her connection, she was never a member of the Black Panther Party for self-defense. That needs to be clear. She was a member of the Black Liberation Army, which was the more active, more militant offshoot of the Black Panther Party for self-defense. They were going where the Black Panthers were not going, in terms of what we are defining here as the armed struggle. Now, it was a pretty much cut and dried police brutality case for what happened with her that led to her being helped by the Weather Organization, which was without doubt a militant white organization that you don't really hear discussed too much. Most people didn't really hear anything about Bill Ayers or the Weathermen until Obama ran, only because they're from Chicago and there was a weak political connection to that. But what I want to ask you is, with the heat now in terms of Asada Shakur being placed as the first woman on this terrorist watch list, and then you have Mandela, who didn't get off the list that they're praising today into 2008. We're looking at 2013, 2008. We're talking about a similar struggle now. You know, how does this work? And then you have a group like the MEC, which is violent, which obviously does not believe in democracy. We see the same thing happening with Libya. They supported the armed struggle, if you want to call it that, against Gaddafi. And what is happening in Libya? What is happening to the black population? Or as they like to say in the international press, the sub-Saharan population that had the support of Gaddafi in Libya.
What is happening there now? What is happening in Syria right now? What has been happening in Syria with the supposed armed revolution? Who are these people? You know, we're talking about religious-led jihadi, for the most part, admittedly so, leading groups, something that we are told here that the war on terror is against. And then we look at Mandela, who was not leading a religious or even a race-based movement. He was simply looking for justice in his own indigenous homelands. How does anything that Brother Mandela was involved in get lumped into what they are connecting Assata Shakur to? And especially when we look in terms of the efforts that were used to get the Mech off of the watch list. And then we have Peter King, the representative from, I believe it's New York State, who is part of one of these Senate Intelligence Committees, who was an admitted Irish Republican Army supporter.
Right.
Who only stopped his support for the Irish Republican Army because they were against the U.S. invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, when we talk about terrorism, when we talk about liberation movements, and we talk about freedom movements, and when we talk about nonviolence, what are we really talking about now?
Right. No, I think that's a great question. And as I was saying earlier, that's why I don't like to use the word terrorism that much, because to answer your question quickly, the term terrorism, really, there's a dictionary definition and there's an actual definition. I think the dictionary definition is kind of clear. Like, you know, it's basically killing civilians for a political purpose to instill fear and terror in someone to achieve some sort of political goal. That, for the most part, I think that's a pretty understandable definition. The actual understanding and real meaning of terrorism today and how it's used, really what it means is violence committed by a group that I don't like. That's really what it amounts to. So groups like the MEK can be involved in like violence against civilians, but if they're fighting for, if their goals align with the goals of the U.S. government and U.S. hegemony, which at the moment they do, because they're antagonistic towards the Iranian government, and so is the United States. And so hence, like, MEK and U.S. are kind of like, hence the cooperation between the two. A group like the MEK is like, oh, okay, we're going to try to get them off the terrorist list. Because what they actually do in practice does not matter. And that's why I mean that the actual definition of terrorism, maybe the dictionary definition of it, doesn't really matter. All it really matters is, like, terrorism really comes down to violence committed by a group that the U.S. government does not like.
Okay, now let me interrupt you here for a second so that we can give a broader view to this. The Ku Klux Klan in the United States was defended by the American Senate in 1948, when the 1948 Convention on the Punishment and Prevention of Genocide Law was being passed in the United Nations. Now, they did not, the U.S. is not a full signatory to that law for the simple fact that they would have had to come down on the Ku Klux Klan for racial terrorism in the South, in the North, and in many parts of the Midwest. And to protect them, and to, you know, basically not have to answer for this, the White Citizens Councils, the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, and what have you, you know, the various white supremacist groups that have been running about in the United States, you know, that is still not looked upon, that is still not identified in the United States as terrorism. Now, you know, taking all of what you're saying into account, where does the KKK, where does the, or the like J.T. Reddy, the white supremacist who killed his family, then killed himself, Timothy McVeigh, Eric Rudolph, some of these other people who have been inspired by Fox News and other white ring radio, you know, where does this fit into this discussion while we're talking about Mandela?
Right, well, terrorism. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan straight up was a terrorist group. I mean, they were one of the first real terrorist groups in the U.S. I mean, they went around killing, burning, lynching black people left and right. And the whole goal was to basically intimidate and instill fear in black people. If that doesn't qualify as terrorism, then I don't know what does.
But they're still operative.
They were clearly a terrorist group.
But they're still operative. WikiLeaks, you cannot give money to WikiLeaks, but you can donate money to the Klan via PayPal.
Right. But and that doesn't get considered as, like, material support for terrorism. You're probably not going to get prosecuted for that. I mean, probably not to the extent of, like, let's say, donating to Al-Qaeda or something. Which is a terrorist group. I mean, let's be clear. Like, Al-Qaeda, like,
they're low lives as far as I'm concerned. They have nothing to do with I'm an atheist, but they have nothing to do with Islam. You know, they have nothing to do with religion. And they don't represent any Arab that it has any kind of concept of common sense, common decency, or anything that is being taught in terms of, you know, common sense, everyday, day-to-day Islamic teachings. It has no relation to it at all.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. And I'm an atheist too, and I have a lot of Muslim friends who would pretty much say the same thing, that Al-Qaeda, like, they're very extreme and, like, just, yeah, totally extreme interpretation, perversion of Islam. Most Muslims do not believe in what they're saying.
But the
most Muslims would not want to be governed by Al-Qaeda either. That's another thing. So,
but the KKK is the Christian version of the same thing.
Right. Exactly. But then look at the response. There's no war on terror against the KKK, right? But the war on terror doesn't just get applied to Al-Qaeda, but it also the Taliban and its term associated forces. You see this in a lot of whenever the Obama administration talks about detaining and killing someone, they talk about Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and associated forces, which basically means anyone who they can think of who has, like, some sort of close connection to Al-Qaeda. I mean, the real definition is, like, a co-belligerent with Al-Qaeda, but that could almost be anyone in terms of, like, just in terms of the real nitty-gritty geopolitics of, like, different countries. If there's, like, a group like a group like maybe Al-Shabaab in Somalia or elsewhere in, like, East Africa or North Africa that is not technically Al-Qaeda, but if they happen to be fighting alongside Al-Qaeda because, hey, the U.S. is, like, launching missiles there, but if that group has a different goal than Al-Qaeda, they get lumped in the same group. Even though that their goal may not be to kill Americans in their homes, their goal may be, like, you know, trying more nationalistic, then they get grouped in with Al-Qaeda, even if their goals are different than Al-Qaeda. You see what I'm saying? So compare that approach, and this is global, by the way, compare that kind of global war on terror approach to the approach against the KKK. I mean, are we waging a war against the KKK? No, we're not. I mean, are we dropping bombs on the KKK? Are we indefinitely detaining KKK members? No, we're not. So, again, that's why I think this term, when we talk about war on terror and terrorism, it's a political term that doesn't mean anything. It's just basically violence committed against a group that I don't like for whatever reason. Yeah, I think that's. I'm glad you brought up the KKK because, I mean, they're a clear terrorist group by every definition of it, but the response to the KKK is totally different than other groups that the U.S. government deems to be terrorists. Which, when you look at the responses to those groups, I think at the end of the day, what it shows is that this war on terror has less to do about fighting terrorism than it is with other geopolitical goals.
Okay, so now that we've got that out the way, how does Mandela fit into this? How can, you know, we actually discuss Mandela with that sort of baggage, or discuss how Assata Shakur can be put on such a list, you know, with that kind of baggage? Because, you know, the way things are going now, when we look at what's happening in LC Potog in New Brunswick, where indigenous people in Occupy Canada are trying to defend their treaty, you know, lands, their ancestral, you know, territories against a fracking company from Texas. We find now that the Canadian state is basically looking at every indigenous person in Canada within their borders as a belligerent, simply for peacefully standing on their rights. Right. So, you know, the criminalization of freedom movements. You know, and then we hear what they're saying about Mandela today. You know, how are we supposed to, as African people, balance any of this?
I think that the term criminalization that you used is very appropriate, because I think that's really what, at the end of the day, the term terrorism is really being marshaled for, is to criminalize and delegitimize groups that the U.S. government does not like. So when it comes to Mandela, the reason why he was put on the terrorist list is because it was less to do with his activities, more to do so with who he was challenging. So he was challenging the apartheid regime. Okay, he's using armed violence against an apartheid regime. Okay, he's a terrorist. Well, what happens in the reverse? I mean, what happens when, like, there are militant vigilante groups committing violence against black people? Do they consider terrorists? Mm-hmm. Not quite. And if they do, their response is not the same. Again, like, we're talking about the KKK. The response to the KKK is not the same as the response to Al-Qaeda. And also another thing, when it comes to responses to terrorism, this is another thing that I think makes this whole war on terror and the use of the term terror such a joke. Because there are terrorist groups out there, and we should be clear about that. And they do want to do harm to people around the world, or, you know, or if not around the world, like maybe, you know, within close vicinity with them. I mean, there are terrorists out there, but there's a reason why they exist, and there's a way to combat them without dropping bombs on people. A lot of times terrorism comes as a result of, like, political, social, and economic grievances, and certain groups use terrorism in order to address those grievances. And so that's usually terrorism is like, it's a result of some deeper problem within that society. That's really what terrorism is. So the best way to get rid of terrorism is to address those grievances. That's really the best way. And there's a study done by the Rand Corporation, the think tank. I mean, they're somewhat right wing, but they did a study that on terrorism I thought was really, really good. They looked at different approaches to terrorism and found what was the most successful approach historically. And they found that most terrorist groups, most times, the way they end is through by dissolving within the political process or through, like, conventional law enforcement tactics. Usually wars, and especially wars of occupation, those have had very, 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 very little success in stopping terrorism. If anything, that kind of approach by bombing people and by invading people, by using all sorts of other, like, military power and violence, that usually exacerbates the problem. That makes it worse. Because then when you bomb someone, then you basically create new enemies. You basically create people who are like, hey, you killed my family, now I want to get revenge on you. Or if anything, you create, like, a potential group, a recruit for groups like Al-Qaeda. So this whole war on terror winds up creating more terrorists than it's fighting against. But so I wanted to also put that out there too, when it comes to terrorism, that usually wars and violence, that makes the problem worse. But if you do other things like resolve it politically, particularly by looking at, like, you know, political grievances that are the root cause of terrorism, that gets rid of it. That gets rid of the terrorism problem, because those groups have less of a reason to exist. So that's something I think that needs to be.
I agree with you. I've always felt that, because if you don't give them a reason, you know, because usually when you're talking about terrorism, you're talking about thugs. You know, this world is controlled by cutthroats. You know, philosophers do not do this.
Right.
People who are reasonable do not. They talk. You know, anybody who is serious about life wants to discuss things, not to smash things. So when you don't give them a reason to act like fools, they have no ground. I mean, if this stuff was actually working, don't you think that, you know, most reasonable people anyway would think that they would have had a, you know, like some kind of a mass following? It's never worked. Adam Curtis from the BBC has put out a series of documentaries that discuss this. That showed that, you know, as extreme as some of these really small and limited groups, they don't have any real following. People don't want this. You know, they assumed that if they shocked everybody, that they could force people to believe in them. And it's done just the opposite. So I completely agree with you. You know, in terms of, you know, I know the right hates to hear this, you know, spreading the wealth and actually doing diplomacy. I mean, even somebody like Henry Kissinger, if you read any of his work, he basically, you know, codified what you just discussed. Talk to the people. Find out what it is that they want. Fill the need. Get what you want.
Yeah.
But basically, don't have anyone leave the table thinking that they've been cheated. Is when, yeah. I mean, he said this, even though he was doing what he was doing during the Paris peace talks in Vietnam himself. But, right. You know, that's another, you know, the discussion for another time. But, Brother Hudson, if you could just give us some final words on Mandela and where we can possibly go from this period to something positive, to something that is progressive, to something that makes sense, and something in respect for what he stood for, what he was about. And, you know, all of those years that he sat in the cell basically for us to earn us our rights. I mean, you know, are there any, this words that you can put on this really sad moment in our history?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think it's good to have a time to mourn. I mean, I have my criticisms of his economic policies, but even when I heard about his death, I was pretty like, just, wow. I mean, I was surprised. I wasn't shocked because, I mean, he died at 95. I mean, that's, you know, I think some of us kind of thought, like, okay, his time's coming soon. But it's still kind of a shock because of, you know, who he was and what he stood for, particularly his long, courageous fight against apartheid and some of the other great things he's done even after that. So, yeah, I think it's good to have a time of mourning, but at the same time, look at his record, honestly. Even the not so pleasant parts, but I would use that as an opportunity to basically learn from those mistakes and try to create something better. So I would, those are pretty much my thoughts. Like, yeah, like, you know, it is a pretty sad day that he passed away, but you know, he put a lot in there for his people and us and other oppressed people around the world. I think, you know, I think that's probably going to be his biggest legacy is that. But I'd also add is to not get distracted by the really shallow crocodile tears that are being shed by, you know, certain cynical political leaders. I wouldn't get caught up in that. Just, you know, use this as an opportunity to educate yourself about Mandela if people don't know about him, and look at his record honestly and learn from it and use it to basically build a better world. That's pretty much what I have to say.
Okay. All right. Thank you for being a guest, man. You know, I'm really glad to have you on, and I appreciate, you know, your insight into this because, you know, as a reporter, you know, someone who, you know, on the daily grind takes a look at the international scene and international view on this. You know, it's good that we have brothers like you out there that are, you know, pushing to give an objective view about what's happening and how the African in the diaspora fits into this. Thanks very much for being on.
Well, thanks for having me on. It was a great time.
Okay, so I want everybody to go check him out, adamhudson.org and at adamhudson5. You can find him on Twitter. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid from The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
I don't like a Negro like that. Here's a man not only throw his reverend in front of the bus, anybody who's standing up for justice. Did you hear him speak out against Sean Bell being attacked? Have you heard him speak about that injustice? No, he tried to carefully cage a speech and make it seem like he's such a great orator. Oh, brothers and sisters, he is a good orator. I'm not going to knock that. But I'm saying to you, I don't like scared to death Negroes. That's my position on Barack Obama. If the man had any gumption, he would stand up and tell the media. That's my reverend. That's my pastor. He has a right to say whatever he has. I have a right to disagree with him. Not strongly condemn him for these bastards. This media, this same media who wants to tell you who the heroes are. They want to prop them up and then knock them down. You listen to these Negroes. You see what happened with Roger Clemens. That was their all American individuals who are all done all sorts of brothers and sisters, again, let us be men. Let us be wise. Look at what happened to Sean Bell. Sean Bell murdered in November of 2006. Over 50 shots rang into this man as he was just celebrating the morning of his wedding with his two of his friends. No weapons. But just as they didn't find any weapons of mass destruction, and you can't count the shots that have went over to Afghanistan, the shots that's went over in Iraq, the shots that's around the world, that you cannot count how many shots have been fired. But we can count 50 shots that went into an unarmed individuals who they thought had weapons of mass destruction. They have yet to apologize. I know one of the brothers said that he was sorry and he apologized, but wanted to shoot 31 times. And the arrogance to thank the judge, to thank everybody, the police union. He thanks everybody, brothers and sisters, I'm telling you, Ku Klux Klansmen. We have no justice, brothers and sisters. You can protest all you want. And I'm saying to you, that you're saying that we won't be violent. We're not going to be violent. We're going to prove that we're not violent. We're going to show that we can rise above this. We see Reverend Sharpton with the family going around trying to say that we're not going to create any civil disobedience or cause any havoc, but we got to have a right to express our views. Brothers and sisters, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that's why you don't want to accept Muhammad. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said you can't fathom the depth of this devil. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad told you who the enemy was, but you want to make mockery of a man can't be a devil. Only a devil would shoot 50 bullets at unarmed people. Only a devil would go into a country and then hang the man and say he had weapons of mass destruction, set up a mock trial, and didn't have the man hung. Only a devil would do these things, but you and I want to say that, come on, America is changing. You got a Texas all man, a former all man who's in charge of the government, who's the president of the United States, and you're wondering why gas prices are $4 now. Brothers and sisters, we are being tricked, but you don't want no one to speak this truth because that's divisive. Oh, brothers and sisters, let us wake up, brothers and sisters. I thank Allah over and over again for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I love the Honorable Elijah Muhammad because he taught us the truth. He said, defend truth at any cost. Stand up and be a man. Brother said, stand up for something or you'll fall for anything. Brothers and sisters, just because somebody stands up and he has black skin, and you know, we threw the baton behind Reverend Jesse Jackson, huh? We had, every time a black man stands up, they want him to condemn and to denounce Reverend or Minister Louis Farrakhan. This is what you say. You got to denounce the Reverend. That's what Reverend Jesse Jackson had to do. You know, he apologized because they said, he said that New York was Hamitown. Then they still call him anti-Semitic. Minister Farr, no matter what, he took the flight to Syria and got back Lieutenant Robert Goodman out there in January of, was it 84, I believe. Whatever he did of good, it doesn't matter. No matter what Reverend Sharpton does of good, it don't matter, brothers and sisters. They have put this jacket on you. And no matter what, Reverend Wright said it happened 20 years ago. Actually, it was June the 24th of 1984. 24 years, brothers and sisters. 24 years ago, and I recorded the speech live. They said that he said that Judaism was a gutter religion, that he said anti-Semitic remarks. He never said the word Judaism in the whole entire speech, brothers and sisters, but it doesn't matter to you. Why let the story, a good story, get in the way of the truth, brothers and sisters, or let the truth get in the way of a good story?
Let me ask a very simple question. Does it concern you that the government is spying on you? 30 years ago, to even ask this question would have been a scandal. If you lived through Watergate, if you read the church committee reports, you know the costs of unchecked government surveillance. The government is exploiting our amnesia. We did not pass the Fourth Amendment in order to protect those with something to hide. We passed that amendment, which prohibits general warrants or limitless surveillance, because we know all too well the cost of an unaccountable government. The question is not, do you have something to hide? The question is whether we control government or the government controls us. Remember, this
struggle is part of who we are as a people. This country was born in rebellion because the British government was exerting too much control over American lives. We broke free and began to create a system of government meant to protect liberty. Our national history reveals a constant struggle to stay true to this value. We face one of those moments of struggle right now. Recent leaks have given us a glimpse into our government's gigantic surveillance machine. It's a machine that is eating our freedom. If this concerns you, and it should, you need to contact your representatives in Congress now. Ask them to end the tracking of Americans' domestic communications. I won't stand idly by while our civil liberties are eaten by the NSA's surveillance machine. You shouldn't either.
You can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year? Whatever, biracial? Not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African-American.
Yeah, I was driving in today, and I was seeing, because I saw this piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he's very white in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean he's very white? He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck. It's What's for Demagogue.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a Listen Live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio. A nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Some who feel no reason for Thanksgiving. To this day, I can hardly bear to think of that quintessentially American holiday, Thanksgiving. When I do, however, I do not dwell on pilgrims with wide black hats sitting to sup with red men, their long hair adorned with eagle feathers. I think not of turkeys nor of cranberry, foods now traditional for the day of feast. Unlike Williams, I do not even think of the day's football games. And not thinking of it, I don't watch it. I think of the people we have habitually called Indians, the indigenous people of the Americas, those millions who are no more. I think of those precious few who remain and wonder, what do they think of this day, this national myth of sweet brotherhood that masks what can only be called genocide? Several years ago, I read a thin text that was pregnant with poignancy. It was a collection of native remarks from the first tribes who encountered whites in New England, and down throughout several hundred years. Throughout it all, the same vibration could be felt, no matter the clan or tribe, a profound sense of betrayal and wrong from people who were treated like brethren when they first arrived. Centuries later, what can Thanksgiving Day mean to Native peoples? Thank you for stealing our land. Thank you for wiping out our people. Thank you for placing a remnant of our once great numbers on rural ghettos called reservations. Thank you for abolishing most of the ancient traditions. Thank you for poisoning what little Indian lands remain with uranium. Thank you for poisoning the lands now inhabited by the whites. Thank you for letting Indians fight in American wars against other people. Thanks. The real tragedy is that millions of Americans don't know and don't want to know about Indian history and traditions. To Today, the names of rivers, lakes, and landmarks bear indigenous markers of another age. The people, except for an occasional movie, are mostly forgotten, out of sight, out of mind. The easier to replace with false images of Happy Meals and turkey dinners. Happy Thanksgiving. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
This is FSNL reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
I Don't Know More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Become idle no more.
You are listening to the Angry and Intelligent Tab Original Radio.
My name is Gordon Hill. I'm from the Kwakwaka'wakw Nation in northwest coast of so-called British Columbia, Canada, and you're listening to Radio Intelligent Indigenous.